A double divorcee who's boasted about his affairs is almost certain to become the Republican nominee for president. Donald Trump has won with the support of about a third of self-identified evangelical Christians. Reuters news agency reported that this week's Republican primary in Indiana would test Trump's evangelical support. Well, he's just won Indiana by 53% and driven his true evangelical opponent, Ted Cruz, out of the race. So what explains it? Sarah Posner is a leading writer on religion and politics. She currently writes for Rolling Stone, and her book is God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And Sarah Posner joined me earlier to explain Trump.
He is drawing people who are at least in some way identify as an evangelical Christian, even if they may not go to church all the time or read their Bible all the time or get involved in anti-abortion politics, things like that, that normally define evangelical voters in elections here. These voters that are attracted to Trump are more perhaps nominally religiously involved, but tend to be drawn to his messages on immigration and guns and keeping Muslims out of the country, not so much driven by the type of issues like abortion and religious liberty.
Yes, I mean, he's not repentant. He doesn't speak about regret in his life. He doesn't talk about turning to God. So right. All of the things that have made other candidates, including George W. Bush, appealed to evangelicals, basically that he was a reformed alcoholic in Bush's case. Mm-hmm. Nothing mm-hmm. seems to apply to Donald Trump in his appeal to evangelicals.
Well, I think this is what led the Republican Party to make its fatal error of thinking that the Trump phenomenon would run its course and somebody else would emerge as the nominee, because the Republican Party has relied for so many election cycles on having a candidate who can talk about religion, can talk about God, can talk about the relationship with God, can talk about the culture war issues in a way that appeals to that big part of the Republican base that is opposed to abortion. And I think that they thought that that formula had worked for so many election cycles that the formula could never be broken, and Trump broke it.
I mean, you've pointed out that Trump can't even get his biblical references right. He infamously referred to Corinthians 2 right. instead of 2 Corinthians. And yet, why do you say that he understands the impulse of evangelicals?
Well, I think that he understands that there is a huge chunk of the Republican Party, which includes some evangelicals, who quite honestly don't care anymore about banning abortion or defunding Planned Parenthood. I mean, they might care, but they haven't prioritized it. The things that they're prioritizing are the things that make them feel like their lives have gone backwards in many ways economically. Trump taps into that, and he taps into it in a way that capitalizes on some religiously motivated discontent, such as the issue of keeping Muslims out or keeping immigrants out. These are conflicts within American evangelicalism that no other candidate has brought to the fore before.
Yeah. Sarah, Russell Moore, who's a mainstream conservative evangelical leader with the Southern Baptist Convention, has basically said that Trump's candidacy has forced very private disagreements between evangelicals now out into the open. Yes. How much has Trump fractured that evangelical coalition?
I think he's fractured it a great deal. There were issues that were percolating within evangelicalism, particularly around the immigration issue. And so that was always a concern, because the Republican Party was not listening to the segment of the evangelical world probably best represented by Russell Moore that is for immigration reform and for welcoming immigrants into America. That fracture was there, but it never became kind of the core issue in a presidential campaign that a candidate used to divide those evangelicals.
In a very perceptive piece you wrote for the Washington Post, you do say that his support comes from a group that we thought had lost their potency, quite frankly, the televangelists. So which televangelists are supporting him?
Yes. And back in the fall or the summer, last summer, he met with a group of televangelists and they laid hands on him and they said all these nice things about him. You know, I think he's had a long relationship with Paula White, a televangelist from Florida. The world of televangelism, which definitely has not gone away, and I think still thrives partly because the Republican Party has given them a pass on using their tax-exempt status to basically run these for-profit enterprises out of their churches. It's very much in line with the Trump view of the world, that there are winners and losers, that a vague sense of a deity blessing you for being one of the winners is evidence of your goodness in the eyes of God, your blessedness in the eyes of God, and is evidence for why you are wealthy. You know, you're one of the winners. You have faith. God's rewarded you with these great riches. That's basically the ethos of televangelism, and it's not too far off from the ethos of Donald Trump.
And Sarah, does this allow the evangelical voter, and indeed sometimes the evangelical preacher, to look past Donald Trump's two divorces, his acknowledged infidelity, his involvement in the gambling industry, his financial collapses? They can look past all of that to rationalize, well, this guy is rich, so he must have God's blessing?
Well, I think that's part of it. You also have to understand that many evangelicals consider the prosperity gospel preached by televangelists to be a heresy. So they dislike televangelists as much as they dislike Donald Trump. But for evangelicals who don't look askance at the prosperity gospel, Trump's wealth and his pledge to bring greater economic prosperity to America is a big part of why they like Trump. That is exactly why Jerry Falwell Jr., for example, said he endorsed Trump.
Sarah, you have said that Donald Trump doesn't have an economic policy. He doesn't really seem to have very many policies at all. But what he does have is Norman Vincent Peale. Who is Norman Vincent Peale?
Well, he was a pastor who pastored a large church in Manhattan for many, many years, and also had a television program. And his theology, if you will, was the power of positive thinking. And you see echoes of that in the way Trump speaks about policy issues, even foreign policy issues. The speech he gave where it was basically like, well, you know, trust me because I'm really good at everything I do. And so I will make America great through whatever foreign policy I decide to do. He talks about bringing jobs back to America or making our economy great again. And it's not clear at all how he's going to do that. But he basically saying, you know, trust me because I've just been so good at this. That's very much a product of his ego, but it's also a product of this brand of Christianity, which centers on the power of positive thinking and rewards from God for engaging in that kind of positive thinking.
And indeed, that was Norman Vincent Peale's most famous book, The Power of Positive Thinking.
That's
five
right.
or 6 million copies sold, extraordinarily successful. And while there are some similarities between Trump and Norman Vincent Peale, there's also some sharp differences, though. I mean, wasn't Norman Vincent Peale a perpetually sunny sort of character? I mean, he used to write about how gratitude helped your digestion, whereas Trump is not a perpetually sunny character.
Well, I think that he likes to think of himself that way. I think he thinks of himself as someone who is going to bring us out of a very dark time. But I think that the particular combination of philosophies or driving forces in Trump are this sort of prosperity gospel, power of positive thinking, quasi-religion, plus the politics of resentment and discontent. So he kind of brings those things together because on the one hand, he's mining resentments and bitterness and anxieties that working class Americans have. And many of their anxieties are very, very real and justified. But rather than giving them a purely Reaganesque sort of positive vision of how their lives might become better, he combines that with resentments against the people who he wants his followers to think have wronged them, whether that's immigrants or companies that shipped jobs overseas, or Washington insiders, fat cat lobbyists that he likes to speak out against. He really does combine two sort of classically American impulses. Mm. One is that power of positive thinking, and the other is that tendency to mine those kind of resentments in our politics.
Sarah, the Trump family, not just Donald Trump, but his late father, I think Fred Trump, did have a close relationship with Norman Vincent Peale, who ran a very large church in New York City, Marble Collegiate Church. But as I understand it now, relations between the two families are not so good.
Yes, my understanding is that Donald Trump hasn't really been to church in a very long time. And I've seen him a couple of times bring a Bible with him to a speech and wave it around and make it pretty clear that he hasn't really cracked the binding on it. So he likes to say that religion played a very big role in his life as a child and growing up. And it may well have in that way of inculcating him with that idea of the power of positive thinking or the power that belief in God might give you. But it's not very evident that any other sorts of particularly religious impulses have guided him.
Sarah Posner of Rolling Stone and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And you're with Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report.